WCF WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire,
and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Michael Toscano. The strongest storm on the planet this year is churning steadily toward Jamaica. Residents trying to brace for the dawn attack of mighty winds and unstoppable oceans of rain coming. Correspondent Jason Allen is in Kingston expecting flooding, landslides, and widespread damage.
Already we're seeing big waves have come across, and they're tossing debris across roads.
The massive storm has already battered Haiti, killing at least three, and triggered landslides in the Dominican Republic. With the airports closed, tourists on the northern part of the island scrambled to prepare.
This is crazy. We were in line in the grocery store for a good 2 hours before we were actually able to check out and get out of the store and get back to the resort.
The marathon Game 3 of the World Series between the Blue Jays and the Dodgers is over, going into the 18th inning before giving the game to the Dodgers 6-5, as heard on Fox.
11:50 in Los Angeles. Freeman sends a fly ball to center field. Varsho's going back before the catch strikes me. Freddie Freeman has ended it. It's a repeat hero with the last word on a Game 3 classic.
It went past the longest game ever in series history, which was Game 3 of the 2018 World Series between the Red Sox and the Dodgers. A trade deal signed in Tokyo. The agreement signed by President Trump and Japanese Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi calls for the U.S. to charge 15% tariffs on Japanese goods while Japan opens its markets to American rice and cars. The trial of Sean Grayson, the former Illinois sheriff's deputy charged with first-degree murder of Sonia Massey in her kitchen, goes to the jury today. CBS's Jerika Duncan reports Grayson took the stand Monday.
Grayson acknowledged that he did not put in the police report that he told Massey he would shoot her in the face. CBS News legal contributor Jessica Levinson.
This really boils down to a question of credibility. And Grayson is trying to prove to the jury that he acted in a way that was reasonable, that he imminently feared for himself.
CBS's Jim Krasula reports the NCAA must pay a former college football player and his wife $18 million.
In ordering the payment, a jury in Orangeburg, South Carolina, ruled that college sports' major governing body did not do enough to warn the player, who is now 68 years old and suffering from dementia, about the long-term effects of concussions. Several doctors testified in the case that Robert Gethers showed symptoms of CTE.
This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire's real news and great conversation, and home to mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
The Packers shut down the Steelers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports from Pittsburgh, where the Packers beat the Steelers 35-25. Green Bay fell behind 16-7 at the half. Quarterback Jordan Love.
You know, when we came in the locker room at halftime, you know, the message was that we just weren't finishing. We weren't executing our plays, and we weren't locked in on doing the everybody's 111. So, you know, there's plays to be made, and I think we just weren't executing those, and we weren't able to stay on the field. So, you know, I think the first half went by really fast for us as an offense. We had one scoring drive, and so I think the message was just do your job, lock in, and execute.
At one point, Love had completed 20 consecutive passes. Aaron Rodgers on why the Steelers' offense stalled in the second half.
Yeah, we had too many penalties, too many negative yardage plays, and then I wasn't accurate enough on third down, and we weren't creating enough space. But we'll look at the film, and you know, we'll get better, and we got a good team coming in next week.
NBA, the Bucks with a loss on the road to the Cavaliers, 118-113, despite Giannis with 40 points. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire's real news and great conversation.
And home to Matt and Air on Air, weekday mornings from 9 to 11.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly to mostly cloudy tonight with lows in the low 40s. A cloudy day for tomorrow with showers developing. A high in the low 50s. Sun's back on Wednesday. A high in the mid 50s. It'll stay dry through the rest of the work week. It's 39 right now.
Maggie Dawn.
At 5 o'clock, I talk with Chicago attorney Robert Held, who is among the protesters who were detained for protesting outside the ICE facility in Broadview. We discuss his 8 hours in custody.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
What's going on with Earl Ingram?
The No Kings rallies across this nation, they reminded me of, it was an organization called the Tea Party. Senior citizens were a part of the Tea Party. And there are a lot of senior citizens involved in the No Kings rallies.
Listen to the Civic Media exclusive podcast, What's Going On with Earl Ingram. Find the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Matt Nair on air.
Attorney General Pam Bondi said that they had arrested the girlfriend of the head of Antifa. Troy from Mount Horeb is on the line. Good morning, Troy. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I am the head of Antifa.
You are?
Yes, and I think my wife turned in my girlfriend. So,
you're in trouble now, Troy.
Matt Nair on air, weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. You're listening to 93.5, The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
They wish to break the entire thing. That is the objective. It isn't about efficiency. It's about breaking it. And it's about breaking it for what end?
Now, the Maggie Dawn Show continues.
Gerrymandering is bad for everybody.
From Congress and courts to burgers and baseball.
I'm grossly discouraged, and I have given up on any justice in our system. It doesn't exist anymore.
Once again, here's lawyer and economist Maggie Dawn.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome back. If you're rejoining us, I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. My next guest, friend of the show, many of you will recognize his expertise as well as his voice. His name is Benga Ajilore. He is the chief economist for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He most recently served as a senior advisor in the Office of the Undersecretary for Rural Development at the USDA. You know, the USDA, that federal agency with multiple billions of dollars in contingency funds to fund, I don't know, programs like SNAP when there might be a government shutdown. Yeah, he used to help run that agency. So he's here to help us all be a bit smarter about what is going on related to both the shutdown, its immediate and longer term economic impacts, as well as what might be marinating over there in Asia with Donald Trump popping around Malaysia and Japan. Going to meet with President Xi of China in South Korea later this week. Big economic news there, as well as the fact that we've got a Fed interest rate announcement coming this week on Wednesday, just on the heels of the U.S. Department of Labor's announcement that we now have an inflation at 3%. We're going to get to all of that, but I am so privileged, happy, and humbled to welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show economist Benga Ajilore. Benga, thanks so much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here.
We got you for a whole hour because there's always so much to talk about in the economic news. And so let's start with what seems to be top of mind for everyone these days. For weeks, we have been focused on the Democrats' demand to refund the government, to agree to a continuing resolution to fund the government, that Republicans must agree to restore the funding for the ACA subsidies. Here in the state of Wisconsin, just today, the governor's office coming out with some of the estimates of the explosion in premiums that thousands of Wisconsinites are going to be seeing because Republicans, frankly, don't care if healthcare is affordable for people, apparently. But more recently, people have been focused on the fact that the U.S. government, the Trump administration, is basically saying that come November 1st, in a mere, 4 or 5 days, that people's supplemental nutritional assistance program benefits, their SNAP benefits, will not, those cards that people use to buy groceries to feed their kids, if they are elderly and need that support, if they've got disabled family members they're caretaking for, that those benefits aren't going to get loaded onto the card. Benga, in the immediate term, what's your reaction to this, especially having you worked at USDA? My understanding is they're sitting on billions of dollars that is literally a contingency fund designed for precisely this purpose. Why would the Trump administration allow people to go hungry?
That's a great question, and I don't have an answer because I don't understand what this administration is doing. But to your point, this is a fund specifically for this purpose. The government shuts down. They don't have the appropriations for the next year. They have about $5 billion to be able to put towards doing this until this tide over. And so there's literally no reason for them. And in fact, the purpose, the sole purpose of that fund is to be able to do that. And so there's no reason for them not to do that.
It's shocking to me. And there's so much, I think, misinformation that's out there about who receives SNAP benefits. For example, in the state of Wisconsin, 7 out of the 10 top counties that receive SNAP benefits are rural counties. Over a majority of folks that receive SNAP benefits here in the state of Wisconsin are white or self-report as white. We know that SNAP benefit usage is universal. It's a huge proportion of Americans. I guarantee anybody that's hearing my voice today, you know someone who is currently receiving SNAP benefits. For those that are of working age and able to work, meaning they are not in a full-time caregiver position, they do not have a permanent or semi-permanent disability, over half of those folks are working and still receiving SNAP benefits. So when you talk about working age people, these are people that are working, but simply working basically below a living wage at poverty levels. When you consider and include those folks, folks that are caretaking, folks that are themselves disabled, or folks that are raising small children, that's two-thirds plus of SNAP recipients fall into one of those categories. So I think a lot of the mythology or frankly, dog whistle, if I can call it that, about SNAP recipients is simply false. Other than trying to create leverage, I just don't understand why you wouldn't tap in to those contingency funds, especially when the president seemed perfectly willing to do that to ensure that members of our military continued to receive paychecks during this shutdown.
I don't know. And I think one of the things we have to think about is the broader context. We just had a couple months ago, the Republican Congress and the administration push a bill that cut $187 billion from SNAP. So this is kind of like a through line of just people who just don't care about people who need food assistance. And so at the same time, you have, you know, veterans who use this. And, you know, to your point, this is not people who aren't working. These are people who are working but don't get enough. And so this is a supplement to help people put food on the table so they can spend their money elsewhere. And, you know, one of the other things they want to spend their money on is health coverage, with, again, also being attacked during the shutdown, but also attacked part of the mega bill earlier this year.
Yeah, you call it the mega bill. I like to call it the big brutal bill because it is brutal for anybody that basically has a household income somewhere south of $250,000 a year or doesn't have, you know, like $40, $50, $60 million in the bank. If you're in one of those categories, probably a little bit of a boost for you, but the regular people here, it's incredibly damaging for. Here's one of the points I wanted to zoom out on. First of all, there is a through line between the attack on these programs that are designed to help working people and people who are unable to work due to their own disability or significant caretaking responsibilities for children or their elderly parents or a disabled child, to help these people make sure, as well as the working poor, to make sure that they can have some baseline, not extraordinary, but baseline level of human dignity, get some health care. We know that when people get access to health care, that actually ends up keeping everybody's premiums down because folks seek preventative care. There's less care sought in emergency rooms. It's generally less expensive. You can just go look at Romney Care and what happened in Massachusetts. We know also when we look at emergency food assistance that that is a key element for folks that, again, are working poor in one of these other categories. We can look at the cuts that are proposed to take effect through Medicaid and Medicare, and on and on and on it went in the big brutal bill. What is this obsession, this, I think, factually dubious proposition that seems to have captured the entire Republican Party, that the only people that need help are people who don't deserve help. And yet at the same time, the people that apparently deserve help are billionaires and 100 millionaires and mega corporations. I don't understand how we can find money for tax cuts for the ultra, ultra wealthy folks with their names on buildings that are endowing museums and things like that. But we can't seem to find money to help people who are trying to help themselves. And there seems to be a factual rejection amongst Republicans that people that need these programs are working or are trying to help themselves. Where is the, you know, like, either Democrats are right and people are working and these are people who have earned these benefits and should be able to access them, or Republicans are right and this is all just one big scam. Like, both things can't be true at the same time. Everything that I've looked at from independent organizations, Benga, indicates that we're talking about people that are rightfully eligible for these benefits. Why is there this persistent lie that Republicans seem obsessed with for 40 years, that if people need help, it's because they're bad people and they don't deserve the help?
It's this narrative. And, you know, even though I'm going to be on for a while, you know, we can have, you know, a dissertation on this.
Yes.
And this is, you know, even goes back before 40 years, where you just see this kind of push for lowering social spending and then using that, shift that to lower taxes. And this narrative around the deserving poor versus undeserving poor. And what happens is then that sticks. And so then to make the argument, like, we need to cut, because this is not the first time SNAP and Medicaid have been cut. You know, there was a temporary assistance to needy families, which used to be aid to families with dependent children. And 96, you know, the Clinton don't end it, mend it, right? Like, that was part of that narrative. And we've just done it to the point where, like, TANF is basically a small program. And that's where we're headed with SNAP and Medicaid. And that was the argument that we heard all this year in anticipation of what you call the one brutal bill, is to be able to make that justification for to cut the spending. You have to talk about deserving versus undeserving poor. But we've been doing this for so long that that argument is actually starting to fall on deaf ears, which is why we saw that rural health transformation fund, that $50 billion that basically doesn't do much, because they realize that they've gone too far. And so now we're seeing the same thing here. The reason why we're talking about the Affordable Care Act premium tax enhancements are, you know, going away, is that people understand their health coverage costs are going up and that this is not going to be good for them. Same thing with SNAP, so on and so forth.
Yeah, and we've seen, I think, experiments with this type of, I'm just going to call them, it's austerity economic policy. That's really what this is, except with it's austerity, except for we won't generate or continue to generate revenue at the levels that we have, because we'll give all of these tax breaks to folks that don't need them. And the tax breaks are largely a rounding error for these companies and folks that I'm describing. But we've seen, for example, when we look at Argentina, this sort of economic approach literally ended up tanking the Argentinian economy. It's why we're sending 20 or 40 billion to Argentina to prop up their peso with no guarantee repayment, except for perhaps the American taxpayer payer. We've seen Republicans as governors run experiments like this in states and collapse those economies. From an objective basis, Benga, are there indications that this works at all in an economy as diverse and as regionally diverse as we have here, that has been so reliant on a middle class with robust buying power since the post-World War II economy in the United States?
The only metric that we have to show that this works is the number of billionaires has increased like tenfold. But other than that, everything else has been hollowed out, especially a lot of the rural communities, a lot of the urban cores. And that's what's happened. We just basically hollowing out these communities that were strong and that were vibrant and were prosperous, all to, you know, for wealthy people.
Yeah, it's amazing. Over this period of time, I'm going to call it post-Nixon period of time, really, when Reaganomics has risen in preference amongst Republicans, and now this sort of offshoot of Trumpian economics, which we'll get into some of the tensions between what Reagan and even some neocons believed was good, robust economic policy. The one thing that has been true over that entire period of time is the explosion in income and wealth inequality in this country. They've got that in Argentina, too. Just saying, folks. Don't go anywhere. We're going to continue this discussion about what this economic moment means for Wisconsinites and working people everywhere in this country with the chief economist from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Benga Adjelori, friend of mine, now friend of yours. So don't go anywhere. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Matt Nair on Air.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
Cam Stevenson.
I don't think we've seen destruction at the White House like that since 1812.
The only people working hard in Washington, D.C. right now are the demolition workers tearing down the east facade of the White House. Let's bring in a whole demolition crew, Cam. That was, right. I mean, the metaphor of the year.
It's very symbolic to see the symbol of power in the United States demolished.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Ahoo, this is Robert Pilot of Native Roots Radio. On our show, we share stories from Turtle Island highlighting the people and issues shaping our communities. From protecting water to treaty rights and preserving languages and traditions, we cover it all. Hear voices like Arvina Martin of Emerge Wisconsin, Dr. Stately, Robert Lilligren, and more. Because Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Native Roots Radio, weeknights at 8 on your local Civic Media radio station.
Don't act like that. Don't wear that. Don't think that. I've heard everything you tell yourself every time you felt different. And I want you to know that you can be vulnerable and powerful. That taking care of your mind is taking care of everyone you love and who loves you. Love your mind. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.
We are the National Park Foundation, and together with you, we're creating a future where every person, every generation, gets their chance at an unforgettable moment. Learn more at nationalparks.org/foundation.
Daylight saving time ends this weekend. Turn your clocks back 1 hour and take the extra time to replace the batteries in your smoke detectors, too. A message from your local Civic Media radio station. You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
Local news, weather, and sports on air and streaming on the Civic Media app. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome if you're just joining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. I'm joined by the chief economist from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Benga Adjelori. He's been here before. Love talking with him. We always have a good time trying to make what is going on in our economic news accessible. Benga, right before the break, I was talking about the fact, and then during the break a bit with you, about the fact that what we can see, I would say, over the last 50 plus years on a national economic performance level is repeatedly Republican presidents coming into office, putting in these austerity measures that ostensibly end up unquestionably hurting working folks and the middle class. You see bad economic results. And then you see Democratic presidents largely riding that economic dissatisfaction into office, then undoing some of the impacts of those policies, the economy picking back up again. And then you see this cycle repeat and repeat. What's interesting of note is that the state of Kansas back in May, I think this was 2010, 12-ish, the 2010 aughts, I'll just say, Governor Brownback basically took the entire then dogma of what I'm going to call Republican austerity measures, put it into place everywhere in Kansas. There was no legislative pushback, and it ended up tanking Kansas's economy. Tell us a little bit about what people should know about what is now termed the Kansas experiment. I mean, he literally took Reaganomics, lock, stock, and two smoking barrels and put that into Kansas's economy, and it failed miserably.
I think the way to think about this is that there's been this whole mantra on the conservative side and to a certain extent on the Democratic side where it's like you want to have small government, limited government, where, you know, get out of the way of the private market. And so you cut taxes, you cut spending, and then let the private market flourish. And what we see time and time again, it's not going to flourish. It flourishes for a very select few and everyone else on the backs of other people. And so this is what we always see is that it's not just even austerity about cutting spending, but it's always paired with cutting taxes. You know, you go back to Clinton era, at the end, he had budget surpluses where, you know, we actually had more revenue than spending. And then the first thing Bush does is cut taxes in 2001, 2003, and then again, then the economy tanks in 2008. And then we start, you know, working back again. But then in 2010, you know, the House and Republican House engaged in austerity measures. And, you know, that's when we started seeing, you know, shutdown threats and things like that. So then the economy starts to build back up again. And then it's 2016. And then what do we see in 2017? A big tax cut. And then we had the COVID pandemic. And then there was a lot of money. And then, you know, we actually had a change with the Biden administration where we actually put a lot of money into the economy, a lot of money to, you know, lower and medium income families. And then now what we see this year, same thing, tax cut, spending cuts.
And a lot of this, I mean, if we read beyond just what the headlines are and you know, at the beginning of this second hour of my show, we play a bit of sound where I talk about the point is to break the thing. This isn't about reform. This isn't about increased efficiency. The true point, if you read Project 2025, which is we're simply checking off the list in Project 2025 in Donald Trump's second administration, it is very clear to anyone who has worked in government for more than 5 minutes that the objective is not better delivery of core services. It is stopping core services from being delivered by the federal government, that it is about basically breaking the Affordable Care Act so that it collapses, right? So that the risk pools, so that health insurers do not want to participate and will not provide insurance through the ACA. It is to break programs like Medicaid and Medicare and SNAP. It is not to make those better. And when you look at the Kansas experiment, I mean, that was the Koch brothers, that was Alec, right? That was the bastardization of what Arthur Laffer, you know, supply side economics, which wasn't really what Arthur Laffer ever stood for. It's just a sort of a confused idea of that. This has been scripted. It has been in the Republican playbook, but it is just turbocharged with this added use of tariffs, which is the newfangled tactic from Donald Trump. And this has not worked. It literally plunged Kansas's economy into a recession. Many could call it a depression. The legislature in Kansas tried to undo all of this austerity and tax cut slashing. The governor vetoed it. They had to come back and override his veto to try to save their economy. When we look at this kind of, I think, head in the sand, an objectively unreasonable approach to economics that does not work, and you then take it with this Trumpian chaos tariff policy, which I can't even use the word policy. It changes every day. This is not going to be good for the middle class. And it's really a question of when, not if, right? We see that we haven't really felt the full impact of the tariffs as much as we thought, as fast as we thought, but it is coming. Is it not, Benga?
It is coming, but for some people, it's already here. Just look at what's happening with the farmers. Yes. And, you know, they have the tariffs on their inputs. So you're looking at fertilizer, steel, aluminum. They're already getting harmed by that. You see what happened with soybean farmers, with China stopping purchase. So for, you know, a lot of people, it hasn't come, but for a lot of people, it's already here and they're already feeling the pain.
We're going to come back with Benga Ajilore, chief economist with the Center on budget and policy priorities. On the other side, we're going to dig in to Donald Trump's taco tariff terror. What does that mean for consumers? Maybe the holiday season? What does this maybe framework to get off of the ledge with China mean? All of that, so much more coming up. Don't go anywhere. I'm Maggie Dawn, and you are listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, home for Matt Nair on air, weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m.
CBS News Brief. It took 18 innings, but the Dodgers beat the Blue Jays 6-5 in Game 3 of the World Series. Heard on Fox, the Dodgers' Freddie Freeman.
This one took a little longer, but this game was incredible. Our bullpen was absolutely incredible.
Shohei Ohtani hammered twice and tied a 119-year record with four extra base hits. Category 5 Hurricane Melissa bears down on Jamaica for a dawn landfall expected to ravage the island for a full day. Meteorologist Craig Allen.
Mudslides will cause a tremendous amount of damage. It is quite possible that entire areas will be cut off from power for 2 weeks or more, perhaps as much as a month.
Closing arguments are expected today in Sean Grayson's Illinois trial for the murder of Sonia Massey.
The jury was read its instructions at the end of the day. They now have the option of second-degree murder on the table to consider as well. Not only do they have the three counts of first-degree murder to consider.
WCIA's Brandon Morano, CBS News Brief.
The Packers shut down the Steelers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports from Pittsburgh, where the Packers beat the Steelers 35-25. Green Bay fell behind 16-7 at the half. Quarterback Jordan Love.
You know, when we came in the locker room at halftime, you know, the message was that we just weren't finishing. We weren't executing our plays and we weren't locked in on doing the everybody's 111. So, you know, there's plays being made and I think we just weren't executing those and we weren't able to stay on the field. So, you know, I think the first half went by really fast for us as an offense. We had one scoring drive. And so I think the message was just do your job, lock in, and execute.
At one point, Love had completed 20 consecutive passes. Aaron Rodgers on why the Steelers' offense stalled in the second half.
Yeah, we had too many penalties, too many negative yardage plays, and then I wasn't accurate enough on third down, and we weren't creating enough space. But we'll look at the film, and you know, we'll get better, and we got a good team coming in next week.
NBA, the Bucks with a loss on the road to the Cavaliers, 118-113, despite Giannis with 40 points. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
On your entertainment beat, I'm Pete Schwabe. Lots to report from the weekend box office, including a new champ from the world of anime. Chainsaw Man the movie came in first place with $17 million at the gate. The animated film tells the story of a man who was almost killed by the Yakuza until he was saved by his dog, forcing them to become one, thereby creating Chainsaw Man. The film received a 96% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes and 99% audience score. Coming in second place in its second week of release was last week's champ, Black Phone 2, which pulled in $13 million at the box office. Despite bad reviews, newcomer Regretting You pulled in 12.5 mil, which was good for third place for the drama. Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere finished in fourth place in its opening weekend with $9 million, which was a bit below expectations. And it was Tron Aris in its second week that pulled in just under $5 million, which was good for fifth place at the gate. If you get a chance, see a movie called Truth or Treason. Really solid film. For more showbiz fun, tune in to Nightlight with me, Pete Schwabe, weeknights from 6 to 8 p.m. on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, home for Matt and Nair on air weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly to mostly cloudy tonight with lows in the low 40s. A cloudy day for tomorrow with showers developing. A high in the low 50s. Sun's back on Wednesday. A high in the mid 50s. It'll stay dry through the rest of the work week. It's 39 right now.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
30,000 Wisconsinites could be priced out of ACA insurance completely. Former Assistant Secretary for Commerce and Economic Development, Alejandra Castillo. What's the off-ramp here?
If you haven't called your member of Congress, you need to. The off-ramp can only be individuals like you and I calling our members of Congress and demanding that both the White House and Congress begin to negotiate a real solution.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6.
Hey there, Wisconsin. Tom Hartman here. Democracy is not a spectator sport, so join me each and every weekday right here on Civic Media for the Tom Hartman program from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Covering the news of the day and sharing ways for you to get off the sidelines and get active in your community, because change starts with you. Get involved and tune in to the Tom Hartman program Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. right here on your local Civic Media radio station.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, childcare remains a big issue in Wisconsin, around the country. Corrine Hendrickson will join us in hour number two. Don't miss it.
Matinair on Air, weekday mornings 9 to 11.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Maggie Dawn. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I've got the chief economist for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Benga Adjulore, with me this afternoon. We've spent really the first half hour, Benga, talking about, you know, these two things that are happening right now related to the shutdown, which is the Trump administration's failure, of course, to use the contingency fund, billions of dollars worth, that exists in USDA exactly for the express purpose of funding SNAP benefits or other benefits that might be cut off during a shutdown. They're refusing to do so because apparently they don't care about people going hungry. We've been talking about the Democratic demand to restore the ACA subsidies, that while our healthcare system is so far from perfect, and while it remains anathema to me that healthcare is something that we permit to be provided on a for-profit basis in this country, that is at least helping millions still access affordable health care. They don't care about that. And we've talked about how on a much higher level, we've seen cycles of Republican presidents putting in place, as much as they have been able to, these austerity measures to cut the programs that help working people, people with disabilities, people that are in caretaking situations, maintain the lowest level of human dignity. But it's not true austerity because they're not trying to raise revenues. In fact, the same time they cut those programs, they're basically giving welfare to mega corporations and billionaires who don't need it, and it's a rounding error for them. And we've seen that those cyclical federal levels of policy are often then balanced by Democratic presidents coming in and trying to undo some of those policies, leading to economic growth, speeding up, betterment of the middle classes, and then reverts back to a Republican. What we have now, and we teased this a little bit before the break, is Donald Trump effectively taking that failed Reaganomics model. And again, folks, you can look at various South American countries, most recently Argentina, who applied that and has tanked its economy. The Kansas experiment back from the Tea Party time in the mid-2010s, as another example of how those policies fail. But what we have now is that plus, quote unquote, I don't even want to call tariffs protectionist. Tariffs used at this level are not protectionist. They are the explicit pickers of winners and losers in the economy by a president who's being guided by nothing more than his lust for power and control over various industries. We've seen Donald Trump trying to have the government own portions of NVIDIA. I mean, there's so much weirdness going on that former Republican free traders or free market capitalists would be appalled by. What is this doing? The combination of these things, what is this doing for the middle class? Why haven't we seen as much inflationary pressure as many economists expected from the tariffs? Is it still coming? What should people be concerned about as we move into the holiday season and into 2026?
So you bring up a good point that, you know, with Trump and his lust for tariffs that's been ongoing for like 40 years. And now even in his first term, he wanted to use tariffs like this, but he had a lot of people in his administration who curbed his ambition. And now you don't have those people. And so that's why you have tariff by tweet policies where you have, you know, he watches a TV commercial and then says, I'm going to put 10%, gets upset, gets offended, and adds another 10% to tariffs to Canada, where you just have this kind of wild, you know, chaotic, haphazard tariff policy. And it, reason why we haven't seen it translate totally, it is in some of the prices and prices of certain goods, but we haven't seen it abroad because businesses have been able to anticipate this. So you saw it a lot in the first quarter of this year, a lot of inventory buildup, a lot of stuff so that when the tariffs did hit, everyone was worried about April 2nd, that Liberation Day, they would say, okay, well, we may have to pay more in terms of inputs and things like that, but we could eat those costs and we eat this cost and then we'll be able to ride through this. Now all those inventories are gone and now, you know, they're just going to have to bear it. And so come this season, the holiday season, and we're already starting to see it with certain prices, there's, you know, people look at Halloween candy going up. Yep. In fact, one of the issues with Halloween candy is that chocolate's become more expensive. So if you go to the grocery store, you might see a lot of different candy and not chocolate type candies. It's going to be really interesting to see, but we're going to start seeing it, and we're seeing it in different ways. It's not just the price going up, but, you know, maybe smaller portions, different kind of candy, things like that. But at some point, it's going to hit with prices.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You can look at companies trying to build up inventory. So companies that are able to afford to amass inventory to do that, especially companies that have bargaining power. So when I say that, I mean large companies that have big balance sheets, that have cash on hand, they can amass inventory. They have bargaining power to try to keep their suppliers at lower level of input prices. They're able to adjust inventory mix. If you are larger retailers or you sell a mix of different products, you can adjust those. Again, using leverage for our largest businesses to maintain some pricing advantage. This is the Main Street versus Wall Street, the Walmarts versus your locally owned Ace Hardware or other hardware store, for example. I think there's also, and you tell me what your view on this, I think that there was a very clear incentive structure in place with this Oval Office for companies to try to minimize the impact of those tariffs. I think you've seen an earnings call. You and I discussed the Walmart earnings call last time at length. Companies that have tried, I think, with a lot of knowledge that, especially if they are market makers or industry indicator, big companies, that they don't want to draw the president's attention, negative attention, if they came out and said, yeah, these Trump tariffs, boy, those prices that consumers are paying, they're going right up. Nobody wants to come out and say that because Donald Trump absolutely will engage in company-specific retaliation. He did it, I think, to less effect in Trump 1.0, but to great effect in Trump 2.0, both the carrot and the stick of it all specifically directed at various companies. Is that part of the incentive mix here for companies as well, companies that are able to eat those costs because they are mega corporations or very, very large?
We actually saw this with Amazon in April. Amazon, they had shown some prices and there was actually like a line item that said something about tariffs. And then Trump got really upset. And then Jeff Bezos, or who was leading Amazon, they were like, oh, no, that's not it. And he took it off and they make sure. And so we've seen that actually happen. And the other thing to that point is that it's not about, you know, some of them are able to eat their costs. But some of them, because they have a, you know, open door at the White House, are able to get exemptions from it. We saw this with Apple. There was the tariffs going to be put on computer and computer products, and Apple was able to, you know, get an exemption on that so they wouldn't be hit. And so that's the thing about being a big, large corporation. It's not just that you have the ability to, you know, tie yourself over with the tariffs, but you also have the ability to lobby this administration to be able to be not subject to it, that small mom and pop businesses don't have access to.
And again, so we see, you see it on the individual level, this austerity, but not for rich people and mega corporations. You see that same, I'm going to call it different rules applying for small businesses. They're going to be unquestionably hurt and have been hurt by the tariff terror, even just adjusting their systems for tariff rates that are changing almost on the daily from the Trump administration, much harder for smaller businesses. But on the aggregate, smaller businesses don't have the margins, they don't have the bargaining power, they don't have the cash flows to maintain inventory levels or to curry favor and cut big checks for the vanity ballroom or whatever it may be. For this presidency, it's even on the corporate level, the president's economic policies are not designed to help the little guy. They're designed to help the donor class, whether that's at a corporate or individual level. That's who this economy is working well for. That brings me, Benga, to what is going on with China. When I think of a country whose interests may be at least different from the United States, at the most threatening, perhaps an actual foreign adversary on both a foreign policy and economic power on both of those axes to the United States, but also a country who can have enormous impacts on the middle class, so much of what we consume as a consumer-driven middle class, a lot of that stuff is coming from China. Whether we're looking at our trading partners for farmers and the soybean industry here in the United States, China is an essential trading partner, and it is probably the single country in the world now that has as much, perhaps more, economic power than the United States. So Donald Trump is in Asia this week. He was in Malaysia. He's in Japan today. He's going to be going to South Korea and will be meeting with President Xi of China. Scott Bessent this weekend announcing that there is a, quote, framework to move China and the United States off of this full-on trade war cliff that we seem to be nosing over. How important is this moment? And how prepared is Donald Trump to understand the potential ramifications of the different levers that may be on the table to try to reach a trade detente or even a minimum de-escalation between the U.S. and China?
I don't have a lot of faith in this administration, because we're now entering month 10 of the administration, and they've been dealing with China with tariffs since February. And, you know, even with other countries, they say, oh, we have a framework or we have a deal. And then 3 days later, someone from that other country saying, that's not what we agreed to. And so we actually don't see the documents. And the other thing about trade deals is that that's not something you could do in a couple of days. This is months, years worth of work, documented work that starts from the staff, career staff, and some of the political appointees at, you know, Department of Commerce and things like that who do it. This can't be just some administration doing a tweet saying I've made a deal. And so I just don't have a lot of faith that they're going to be able to reach a deal, because we haven't seen anything since.
When I wonder, like, what, when we look at the leverage points that China has over the United States, rare earth minerals, right? Huge. They are a major importer to the United States of consumer goods that many middle-class households rely upon, electronics, etc. And we look at China as an importing of major agricultural products. Where is our leverage coming from? I know China wants access to our markets and our consumers, but given that it is a state-controlled economy, President Xi seems to be able to exert a lot more control over that economy. And they have things that we need in the immediate term, read rare earth minerals and those consumer goods. Where is our leverage going to come from?
We don't have much leverage. And Chinese know that they could kind of wait us out, that they could wait this administration out. There's even talk about, like, the TikTok deal was kind of like just something to give us to tie us over. And so we don't have the leverage. And that's what's scary about what's happening and what will happen in the coming months.
I'm hearing reporting earlier today that there are many in the depleted but still existent U.S. Department of State that are deeply worried that Donald Trump might have some announcement about the U.S. going hands off in Taiwan and the global catastrophe that could portend. Watch this space. When we come back, we're going to talk about where interest rates stand right now, what the Fed's interest rate announcement this week could mean, and how all of that relates to the consumer price index and what we are seeing writ large for inflation. So stay tuned. It matters to your pocketbook and mine. We got Benga Agyilori, chief economist at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, with me, Maggie.
Connecting audiences, powering brands. This is Civic Media. Learn more at civicmedia.us/advertise.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation just announced the official start date for one of its biggest ever construction projects, the I-94 East-West Project, which will reconstruct and widen a 3.5-mile stretch of interstate highway in the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. This is a massive project with an estimated cost of more than $1.7 billion. And with this official start date announced, also came estimates for how long this will take. Construction is expected to last until 2033. At the Recombobulation Area, this project is something we've covered extensively, including with an award-winning four-part series called Expanding the Divide. It might be worth revisiting that series and considering how unnecessary and expensive an extra lane is, and how in southeastern Wisconsin, we're going to be dealing with construction and delays for the next 8 years in order to shave a few minutes off suburban commute times while the city streets and city problems go ignored once again.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area.
School sports are played by humans, coached by humans, and officiated by humans. So the next time you're sitting in the stands at a school athletic event, please remember this and maintain your humanity, especially when it comes to judging and critiquing athletes, coaches, and officials. Please show your fellow humans some respect. They'll appreciate your empathy.
This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Busted pencils, fully lettered education talk.
You know, one of those things, and speaking about AI, guess what I did? I used AI to prepare for the show today, Johnny. You know, Of course I did. I got it together, put up a little outline. You know, the suggested title, AI, Apocalypse or Opportunity.
Well, you can guess what the AI thinks, Tim.
Yeah. Subscribe to Busted Pencils wherever you listen to podcasts and at civicmedia.us.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
What is your favorite or least favorite word? Cinnamon. Love that word. And it's a superfood. I don't like the word buttress just because I'm immature. Pecan.
My favorite word is scoundrel. I would also say buttocks.
I said buttress and you said buttocks. John in Madison says words with silent letters bug me too. Pneumonia. Dumb. Funny because my name is John.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for youth.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals into your body.
And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media.
Many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping.
Because when you talk, they hear you.
Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
As Wisconsin is saying the word bag instead of bag, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome if you're just joining us. My name's Maggie Dawn, and this is the Civic Media Radio Network. We're in the last segment of the day, and I've asked my good friend, Chief Economist for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Banca Agilori, to stick around with me. We've been talking about the current state of play here in the United States when it comes to economics and some of the recent goings on. We have covered the disconnect, the fact that Republican policies just don't work well for the middle class or working poor folks. It doesn't work well for small businesses. And there is 50 years of objective economic data to support that. We've talked about the fact that even when you turn to the traditional Republican policies, what we've got with Donald Trump is sort of turbocharged to hurt regular Americans and benefit the ultra, ultra wealthy, the donor class, and the mega corporations with Donald Trump's taco tariff terror that seems to flippity floppity every other day and seems to have no through line other than what's going to work for Donald Trump and his billionaire donors. That's a departure from traditional Republican economic orthodoxy, this broad use of tariffs. And late last week, Donald Trump seemed to be surprised to find out that the man most revered by most Republicans, Ronald Reagan, was quite anti-tariff. One of the provinces in Canada put out an advertisement on social media in opposition to Donald Trump's strong-armed tariff tactics vis-a-vis Canada, and quoted from a speech that Ronald Reagan gave about tariffs back in the 80s that basically said, these don't work. These drive up consumer prices and hurt businesses in the United States. It was basically the nutshell. And Donald Trump is now threatening to shut down all trade negotiations, or did that, and maybe higher tariffs on Canada. We are already seeing them on steel, timber, and aluminum, which is hurting housing starts and all kinds of businesses that rely on those inputs here in the United States. But Benga, were you a little surprised? Maybe not surprised is the wrong word. Riley amused by the fact that Donald Trump seemed utterly shocked. Shocked, I say. Or completely unaware of the fact that traditional Republican orthodoxy is very anti-tariff, that Ronald Reagan was very anti-tariff. He seemed to not know that little tidbit.
He did seem pretty surprised by that, which is not shocking because he doesn't really know much outside of what he believes and just assumes everyone goes along with him. And so what is actually really funny about that ad was that it was actually played also during the World Series between Toronto and L.A., and so a lot of, you have millions of people are watching it who see that ad and hear Ronald Reagan's words being anti-tariff. And so he probably felt they were somewhat needling him.
I think they were. I mean, Canada's been pretty good at Trump trolling, I would have to say. A national hobby, if you will. Of course, we got game three of the series this evening. Personally, I'm going to be rooting for the Blue Jays because who wants the team with the biggest payroll in baseball to win? That's just nonsense. But he claimed that it was AI generated. I went and looked up the speech, the clips that were used in the advertisement. To the best of my ability to research and decipher this, and what I saw verified in other news reports, is that they were clipped. And maybe not in the order that Reagan said them, but he said those things and they didn't alter. There was no AI generated Reagan voice. Like, I wonder, Benga, is anyone there in the Oval Office saying, no, Mr. President, don't say that. Reagan did say those things. Are you curious to know why Ronald Reagan was so anti-tech? Like, there's no one there telling the man the truth about anything, which just seems to be so shocking. Why do you think, just this is wild speculation, but I'm fascinated by it, Benga, why do you think a guy like Scott Bessent, who clearly knows better, I don't know about Lutnick the Nudnick, but Scott Bessent knows better, why is he not saying any of this to the president?
I think what we have is that when you look at people who are in the White House, people who are working for the White House, they have a specific point of view. And it's a point of view that aligns with what the President Trump wants. And unlike the first term where you had people with different views and debates and be able to push them certain ways, if you believe that tariffs don't work, you're not working at this White House. So anyone who works at the White House who saw that ad would then say, oh, just say it's AI generated and keep doing what you're doing. And so anyone who's choosing to work with this administration is aligned with everything that this president wants.
Yeah, or they've been kicked out, quote, early retirement, and those other ideological purges that have happened. Briefly, we saw the Department of Labor last week, despite the fact that data collection is basically shut down during the shutdown. Looks like the CPI is now at about 3%, which is up a bit, but not quite yet at the inflation alarm level. We've got the Fed that's going to make an interest rate announcement on Wednesday. Most expect the Fed to reduce interest rates. What's going on there with this interrelationship between increasing inflation, but it's not skyrocketing, and the Fed and the interest rates? What are they trying to accomplish right now?
So they're trying to balance that trade-off between making sure that unemployment doesn't go up and that the labor market stays strong and that prices don't go up. And so while they understand that prices are going up because of tariffs, what they're saying is that the tariffs are only going to have a temporary impact and that the labor market is actually weaker. And so they're making the decision and they're probably going to do another quarter percentage point cut to make sure that the labor market stays strong and not be as worried with inflation as much.
Fascinating, given the Trump flip-flopping. If it really was such a golden panacea, Why would he be negotiating such lower trading tariff rates? Nobody knows, because he just makes it up. But my guest doesn't make it up. Big thanks to Banca Agilore from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. It's a pleasure to be with you as always, Banca. He'll be back soon to give us more economic updates. That's going to do it for me, folks. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But it's always better when we stand together for the middle class.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Michael Toscano. An unprecedented assault of wild wind and water is approaching Jamaica, the fury of nature harnessed and whipped up by Category 5 Hurricane Melissa for a sunrise landfall. Resident Susan Brown urges people to get away from coastal waters.
I think they should evacuate and leave down here, because down here does not look safe.
Meteorologist Craig Allen says Melissa is the fiercest hurricane to hit Jamaica since record-keeping began in 1851.
There would be similarities to an EF3 tornado affecting the island for about 18 to 24 hours. So we're talking about 175-mile-per-hour winds, a storm surge with seawater inundation of 9 to 13 feet, and rainfall on top of that. This would be freshwater flooding of anywhere.